Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Roselevy. I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of food, health, and the environment, talking about science, healthcare, policy, the media, and cultural attitudes and beliefs about health. Each week on Connect the Dots, I talk with different experts, advocates, journalists, scientists, filmmakers, book authors, and many, many more about the various things going on in our interconnected world that impact our well-being, the well-being of our communities, the well-being of our society, and the ecological thriving and survival of our habitat, planet Earth. On this week's show, I'm delighted to be joined by a guest who's written an important book. I think the book itself is important. The fact that it found a publisher and is now out there is really terrific because, it's hard to sometimes get these breakthrough stories out to the public, even as many are aware of or suffering from various issues of our failure to make health and public health a top priority. So this is a public health book, in effect, and that puts it in my, at the top of my list. Our guest today is Mary Beth Pfeiffer. She's the author of Lyme, the First Epidemic of Climate Change. Mary Beth has been a journalist for four decades. Since 2012, she's emerged as a leading investigative reporter on Lyme disease, attracting national and international attention, and has garnered seven awards for her groundbreaking articles on this topic, including the prestigious Society of Professional Journalists Sigma Delta Chi Award. She's a graduate of Morris College in Poughkeepsie, New York, began as a hometown reporter and has been reporting for the last 30 years for the Poughkeepsie New York Journal, where many of these articles that went to make the book were first published. A previous book of hers is Crazy in America, The Hidden Tragedy of the Criminalized Mentally Ill. That's another really important topic. And I think nowadays that's also worth maybe a future conversation because, with the additional stressors in our society on all levels, I think more and more we're seeing as more and more people become troubled, have drug problems, and, all the rest of it, that we're really not doing what we need to, both for people's health care and for mental health care. And therefore, people with mental illnesses wind up marginalized or even criminalized. And that's pretty inhumane and kind of terrible. On this show, however, we're going to be discussing the first epidemic of climate change, Lyme, a disease spreading rapidly around the world. So welcome to Connect the Dots, Mary Beth Pfeiffer.
Thanks so much for having me, Allison.
Now, let's just plunge right in. Among our listeners, I am sure that there are some who are well aware of the terrible Lyme epidemic that we're having and have themselves or family members who have struggled with this kind of under-the-radar disease. And I'm sure there are also people listening who, think of it as a distant problem that could never affect themselves. They don't really know much about it, and they don't understand the various components that your book covers about why this is becoming a rapidly growing epidemic, what the tragic underestimation of its dangers and inadequate treatment, fails to provide. Let's, if you would, please give us just a little primer for the uninitiated about the Lyme problem, the Lyme epidemic.
Well, as you say, Lyme has been under the radar for way too long. It infects an estimated 300,000 Americans a year. It is global. It is every bit as bad a problem in parts of Europe, Germany, France, the Netherlands, Scandinavia as it is in certain parts of the U.S., parts that are growing, by the way. It's primarily in the Northeast and the Midwest. These are the hotbeds of Lyme disease. But a study came out just last week by Quest Diagnostics showing that Lyme is growing hugely and that cases have been diagnosed in every one of the 50 states and the District of Columbia. And we know that it's growing because we also know that ticks are moving. Ticks are moving up latitudes. It's getting warmer. We see that in the temperature data that comes out every year, with one year often being hotter than every other year on record. I think 8 of the last 10 years have been the hottest on record. This has created a situation that has not, invented Lyme disease, but has abetted Lyme disease. Ticks are now able to live in places they could not live before. We've also adulterated the environment. We have these small forest fragments that many of us live near that we love to go to and we love to hike through. There are walking trails and so forth. But this adulterated version of nature is not in its natural state. It is unbalanced. So, for example, we don't have enough foxes anymore. That would keep the rising mouse population under control. We have too many deer. So deer, mice, ticks, warmer temperatures, these are all combining to create this perfect storm of tick-borne disease and especially Lyme disease.
What are the carriers of Lyme? You mentioned mice. Deer is a traditional carrier. Are there more carriers of this than has previously been thought or that, you know, that we've heard about?
Well, the so-called reservoirs of Lyme disease, namely those little mammals out in the environment that infect ticks when they're newly hatched, are different in different parts of the country. Primarily in the Northeast and the Midwest, mice and chipmunks and sometimes shrews and sometimes other small mammals are really the first place where the newly hatched tick goes to feed and is infected with Lyme disease. In California, a type of squirrel is the leading mammal that infects ticks with Lyme disease. And we also have in this picture, as you said, deer. But deer don't really play a huge role in infecting ticks because only, say, 1 in 10 ticks that feed off a deer will actually become infected with the Lyme disease bug. 9 out of 10 ticks that feed off a mice will become infected. But the deer play a key role because they're the place that the adult ticks go to have their final meal, go to meet their mate, and to live out their life's destiny, basically, to make more ticks. I call deer the marital bed of ticks. And, yes, they play a huge role, and they're a big problem in this situation.
And what about other insects? Is it just ticks? Do spiders, can they become infected? Can mosquitoes be carriers? Or is it only ticks that we have to worry about?
There isn't any good data in the scientific literature that suggests other insects carry Lyme disease and can infect us. We have to be afraid of ticks. Now is the time to be very vigilant about avoiding tick habitat, about not brushing up against tall grasses, and maybe even treating our clothing and our backyards with something that will reduce the population of ticks. But, yes, it's really ticks that are spreading this disease.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, my understanding is, and I've done previous shows on this, they're also there are also inadequate treatments. I mean, that people rely on tests, and the tests are not that accurate. What is your view of the treatment for Lyme disease? What are the shortfalls that you see?
Well, it's pretty well documented that many people remain ill after they are treated for Lyme disease. Something like 10 to 20%, and this is in the scientific journals, continue to have symptoms a year or more after they've been treated for Lyme disease with the frontline antibiotics that have long been recommended for treatment. So we know that there is this segment of the population that stays sick. The question is, why do they stay sick? And, you know, we have a very, very dogmatic view of Lyme disease. And when I say we, I mean the mainstream medical journals and community. I mean the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. We have often said and often endorsed the guidelines, the prevailing guidelines for Lyme disease, which were written first by the Infectious Diseases Society of America and have been sort of copied by other medical societies as well. And what these hold is that 10 to 28 days of antibiotics will eliminate the Lyme disease pathogen in the body of someone who's infected. Well, new research is really beginning to question that paradigm. We're seeing experiments being done at really top-notch universities like Northeastern and Johns Hopkins and Tulane, in which scientists have infected mice, they've infected monkeys, they've infected other small animals going back even before this new wave of research, gerbils and hamsters, for example, beagles even. And then after they infect these animals, they treat them with the antibiotics that you and I would get if we go to the doctor with Lyme disease. And lo and behold, they're finding that even months later, a small number of what they call Lyme disease persister cells remain in the bodies, or at least some of the bodies, of these infected animals. So this is suggesting why a share of people remain ill. You know, I'm not saying you can't be cured for Lyme disease. Many people are, and they go on to live out their lives very happily and in good health. Usually, I would add, if they are diagnosed quickly and treated early. But this suggests why there is that core group of people who stay sick long after they're treated. And we really have to pay more attention to this group. We need to do more research to find out what's going on inside these people. It may not be that they're chronically infected. There are some other theories out there about some sort of autoimmune response that has been triggered. You know, all that's well and good, but we do have evidence number one that many people remain ill, and evidence number two that there is continuing evidence of spirochetes, that's the germ that causes Lyme disease, in the bodies, at least of animals, and in test tube research as well.
Mm.
And we probably should talk. You mentioned the tests. Go ahead.
No, go ahead about the tests. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess, you know, you really can't talk about the treatments without talking about the tests.
Right.
There are, you know, myths about Lyme disease. And, you know, one of the major myths, along with the fact that we can treat it adequately, is that we can diagnose it well. And that's again, one of the, truisms of Lyme disease that have been told to doctors. Doctors have been told, trust what they call the two-tier test for Lyme disease. It will accurately diagnose your patients. Well, there's a lot of research that shows that cases are missed by that two-tier test. The two-tier test is basically, it's an antibody test. So, you are exposed to the pathogen, to the germ, and your body needs to muster these antibodies, which we then measure to see if you are infected. And some people just don't have a good antibody response because their immune system might be weakened by the infection or by other illnesses they have. There are a host of reasons as to why people don't test positive. It's too early in the disease, for example. But suffice to say that there is a share of people who never test positive for Lyme disease on this two-tier test. And, you know, we've been relying on this test since 1995. Other tests have been in development, have tried to break through. But because of this dogmatic view that we have, that the test works, the treatments work, no other test has been able to come along and take its place.
Yeah, that's kind of, that's crazy, isn't it, really? I mean, and why do they have this dogmatic view? In your investigation, I mean, did you develop any inkling of why that would be? Because it just seems so incredibly counterproductive, you know, to just hold to one test. Is it laziness, lack of funding? What, you know, what? Why? Why are they doing this? Do you have any idea?
Well, there are several reasons for this. First of all, there is research that shows the test works. It works at various stages of the disease. So every time somebody, you know, someone on the other side of the Lyme divide, if you will, comes along and says, but the test doesn't work for this group of patients, the answer is, well, you have to wait a while. If you wait a few weeks, the person will develop some more antibodies, and then you test again. But that's really a very flawed way to manage a disease like Lyme disease, because the Lyme spirochete moves throughout the body. It quickly leaves the bloodstream. And because of its mechanisms, because of its shape, it's shaped like a corkscrew. And it has an internal flagella, which is the thing that kind of propels a bacteria forward. And because of its very construction, it is able to drill through cartilage, through tough joint capsules. It's able, unlike many other bacteria, to pierce the blood-brain barrier. So it moves to many places in the body. It moves to places that antibiotics can't reach. Now, among the other reasons why this test has been upheld for so long is because of the power of the one group, the small group, I would add, that really believes in it and hews to this test and to this overall paradigm. This group, you know, came to Lyme disease early. They've been involved in Lyme disease research for a long time. They are, by and large, the authors of the original guidelines, the guidelines of the Infectious Diseases Society of America. They have connections. You know, these are the way, this is the way the world works. They have connections to people in major medical journals, like the New England Journal of Medicine, like Clinical Infectious Diseases Journal, which is actually a publication of the Infectious Diseases Society. You know, they have friends in the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. I actually wrote a story in which I obtained emails that were shared among CDC and IDSA members, so you could see this this, you know, kind of trust between them. And I don't fault them so much for that. What I do fault is the government for failing to keep an arm's length with the with that kind of privileged group, for failing to recognize that there is other emerging research about Lyme disease, and for failing to recognize it, that it is telling us something, for failing also, frankly, to listen to patients. I think, you know, as an investigative reporter, that was the thing that really clinched it for me. I listened to the patient stories. There are hundreds of Lyme disease groups around the country, and these people are telling us something. They're telling us they're still sick. They need attention. And, you know, lastly, I would say, you know, why we have this whole dogmatic view is it has really led to a situation where we don't think Lyme is an urgent problem. We don't think ticks are an urgent problem. We haven't spent the money to figure this disease out. In a nutshell.
Really, you know, it's really interesting because there's just this dynamic, and, you know, it happens time and again because, you know, people have an idea of science that, you know, science, you know, is on top of everything. And, you know, if it isn't afflicting you personally, then we tend to have like a wait and see, which, you know, that can be appropriate to have a wait and see, you know, response. But there's also just all this kind of doubt and cast station as if each time we go through this, whether it's, you know, and I don't know your thoughts on this issue, but we've had a big win on the health problems with glyphosate in court this very week. Mm-hmm. And yet for many years, people were, oh, it's impossible that, you know, if this were a problem, the government would know. And so they kind of play hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil. You know, they're kind of just, and it's, a, you know, there's a body of people and even some scientific evidence that's saying this is a problem. We tend to want to believe it isn't unless it affects us directly. And yet, as you pointed out, toward Lyme disease, there is this, you know, kind of mounting cry, mounting group of people having, you know, these terrible persistent problems with it. And yet, you know, we kind of want to turn down the dial on that and say, oh, it must just be their problem until the day it's on our doorstep.
Your mention, Allison, of the Roundup case, the glyphosate case, is very, very instructive because that was a chemical widely used in our environment to battle insects and was defended for years and years as being safe and effective, no problem. And there was science to defend that as well. And by the way, that is a big win for my publisher as well, Island Press, because we have a book out by Carrie Gillum just about that problem, the problem with Roundup, and it's called Whitewash, which is a reference to the way in which...
Right.
Oh, good.
She's been a guest on this show, and in fact, listeners can go into the Connect the Dots archive, which is at connectthedotspodbean.com, podbean like the bean that you would cook. And just within the last month or so, and in fact, she's been off on travel and may be coming back to the show because she's also had the experience, and it's true for any journalists who are kind of doing cutting-edge material, you know, everyone sort of doubts you, and then, you know, sometimes if it's threatening, as in her case, a large industry, people come after you. You know, people actually go after the journalists who do this, and she's had a big experience of that with the publication of this book. So we've been in conversation and we're coming back on.
She's a terrific. She's a terrific investigative reporter.
And she's been doing the definitive work on glyphosate and on this topic. Actually, there have been many books even that preceded her, and we've featured them all. And yet, you know, there is this public, and concerning your topic, you know, Lyme disease, I mean, I've talked with people in regions of the country in the Northeast, you know, where it's quite prevalent. And it is, and, you know, you can actually, I mean, I've had the experience of saying to people, unfortunately, the test is not definitive. And in the next sentence, people will often say, well, I got the test, and they say I'm in the free and clear, you know, or I got the, you know what I'm saying? Or I got the test, and there was another outcome. It's so hard for people. There's such trust in these, you know, kind of establishment medical institutions like the Centers for Disease Control, you know, for people to even somehow be able to know
Yes.
That, you know, this is a problem. Have you encountered that?
Well, yes. You know, sometimes science gets it wrong. As mm-hmm. with Roundup, I think that has been proven pretty definitively in this, you know, court decision. And, mm-hmm. you know, just even going back, 20, 50, 100 years, the first doctor who came along and said that surgeons and doctors who deliver babies should wash their hands before they go into the operating room. And mm-hmm. this scientist, a guy by the name of Semmelweis, was vilified, and he died in a mental institution. Nobody believed him. And what we had was young doctors, internists, coming from cutting up bodies in autopsies to delivering babies, and they never washed their hands. Well, you know, that was proven mm-hmm. to be a pretty bad practice. You know, when mm-hmm. when Teddy Roosevelt was a boy, he was treated by inhaling for his asthma cigar smoke. They thought cigar smoke would help asthma. You know, sometimes we get it wrong. And one of the ways I think we've gotten it wrong with Lyme disease, beyond the treatments, is the tests. And, you know, in doing my research on Lyme disease and on the tests, I looked at the scientific literature, and I found 30 papers that examined the issue of people who were falsely diagnosed with Lyme disease, so-called false positives. And I mm-hmm. found, so 30 papers on that. On the other side, people who should have been diagnosed with it, there were only 5 papers. So the message mm-hmm. that was delivered to doctors was, don't falsely diagnose Lyme disease. And the original paper, the very first paper on false diagnoses for Lyme disease, was written by one of these thought leaders on Lyme disease, a guy by the name mm-hmm. of Alan Stier, who actually discovered and did the first research and investigation into Lyme disease in Lyme, Connecticut, back in the 1970s. So he was very respected. And what I, mm-hmm. you know, contend is that a lot of copycat science was done to prove this theory of false positives. Well, it's much more mm-hmm. dangerous if your diagnosis of Lyme disease is missed than if you're given a round of antibiotics because a doctor suspects you may have Lyme disease. We know that doctors mm-hmm. often do that sort of thing, and they probably mm-hmm. do it too often, give too much antibiotics willy-nilly. But the problem mm-hmm. is the line has been drawn on Lyme disease. And it's been drawn mm-hmm. on that very dogmatic view that we know how to mm-hmm. diagnose it, we know how to treat it. And as a result, mm-hmm. many cases are missed. Many more cases, I would argue, are missed than those that may have been treated of people who actually didn't have it. And mm-hmm. the outcome of that situation has been very dire for many people. You know, long-lasting mm-hmm. debility, cognitive issues, serious pain. We have to change the situation, and I'm glad you're paying attention to this, Allison. I really thank you for doing this.
Yeah, that's really, I think that, you know, I just want to, you know, bring in here, because I feel like we need to also, you know, for the average person, you know, there are people who can have an acute case, as you mentioned, it's treated quickly. You know, there's a visible bite, the classic rash, and so, you know, people, it can be treated, and then some people do have luck taking the 28 days of antibiotics, and they're treated, life goes on. Then there are other people who may be treated and life does not go on, or it may be that it's kind of okay for a while and crops up again later, and, you know, how could this be? And then there are people who never see a visible tick, didn't know that they had it, who for one one reason or another, you know, they don't know that they've been bitten by a Lyme tick. They don't know that Lyme disease may be in their system. And for one reason or another, they maybe have a strong immune system. Nothing happens. And then there may be others who also are bitten without knowing it. And for various reasons, and we don't know for sure because it hasn't been well studied, you know, they go on and develop a persistent case of it. Or the people who thought they were treated and all was well, it can also happen that they go on and develop this more persistent series of symptoms that are more debilitating, and the disease itself goes chronic. And at that point, it's much harder to treat. The conventional antibiotics are often used to treat it. They can go on for years. You know, I know people who've been in years of antibiotic treatment, and as the antibiotics, which are not good, as we know, for the gut, for the microbiome, for the immune system, are used so long-term, they are, in effect, continuing to undermine the immune system that is needed to be, you know, kind of functioning well in order to help people recover. So it becomes this kind of vicious cycle of antibiotic use undermining the immune system. And I've had on the show previously, I think it was in about February, so people who are interested could look for it. Darren Ingalls has written a book called The Lyme Solution, and, you know, talks about other forms of testing, other forms of treatment modalities, that are especially, and actually long-term lifestyle changes, because this is, if it goes into the chronic stage, the likelihood of the quick fix is, you know, somewhat more diminished because you've kind of beaten up the immune system with the antibiotics. Anyone interested in the kind of health prescription side of this, you know, what to do, prevent it on an individual level, can go to that program in February with Darren Ingalls, The Lyme Solution, and get a lot more of this kind of discussion. You know, it's almost, when people have it, unless you're, you know, somebody that knows them closely, they're not like walking out and about, you know, if they have long-term chronic cases. That is equally mystifying to the doctors, is it not, Mary Beth?
Well, doctors, I would say, really avoid entrenched, ongoing, serious cases of Lyme disease because they really have not been given guidance as to how to handle them, how to manage them. So what a GP, what a family practitioner might do is say, okay, you need to go to a rheumatologist, or if you're having heart problems, which Lyme disease can sometimes lead to, you need to go to a cardiologist, or eye problems, go to an ophthalmologist. That's what often happens with Lyme disease patients whose situations have gotten out of control. They are sort of on this merry-go-round of doctors. They're often treated not for the underlying problem, but for the symptoms that they present with. And there are many a Lyme disease patient, by the way, who got caught up in the opioid epidemic because they were given repeated rounds of opioids for serious, often pain in their joints. Mentioned... Yeah, it's there are so many tentacles to this epidemic that it really is quite amazing and quite horrifying. And you mentioned the Lyme solution, the alternative treatments, the lifestyle changes, dietary changes. And this is what people with Lyme disease often do when the infection gets progressed and gets out of control. They have to kind of figure out what works for them. And, you know, that's probably, you know, fairly common with other diseases as well. How do I, you know, manage my rheumatoid arthritis beyond, you know, just taking the medications that I'm given? But Lyme disease patients are in a kind of a class all by themselves because mainstream medicine doesn't acknowledge that they remain sick with Lyme disease. There isn't a diagnostic code for chronic Lyme disease, for advanced Lyme disease. No, there isn't.
Oh, my goodness.
There are a very, very limited number of codes for Lyme disease. And the World Health Organization actually updated the codes this year to include several other categories, which was really terrific, including congenital Lyme disease, which is another extremely controversial subject in the medical literature and in the mainstream medical community generally. It rejects that it can be passed from mother to fetus. There just are a host, so many issues related to Lyme disease. But you went through all of those, you know, ways in which the Lyme paradigm falls down. You know, you have an acute case and you're supposed to get this rash, but you don't see it. And on, you know, you don't see the tick bite. You don't even know that you were ever bitten. And I just would like to talk about the rash itself for a minute, because, you know, that has been held up as, okay, this is the surefire way to diagnose Lyme disease. You don't even need a test if you go to your doctor with the Lyme disease rash. Well, they call it a bullseye rash, meaning it has a central clearing, white in the center and red on the outside. But there are many other manifestations of this rash. You can look at pictures on the CDC website, and some of them are dusky, kind of grayish looking. Some of them have little bumps in them. They even look like spider bites. And not only people, patients themselves fail to recognize this as a signal rash, but doctors sometimes don't even recognize this as Lyme disease. They send people home. I've heard this several times. No, that's a spider bite. Don't worry about it. We can't really rely on the Lyme disease rash. In the best case, 70% of people will get this rash. And that's, you know, that's cases that are reported to the CDC, 150,000 cases, they found 70% had the rash. But those are the best cases. There's a lot of other cases that are not reported to the CDC. So the universe on which to, you know, judge how many people, what percentage have the Lyme disease rash is much larger. So don't rely on the rash. And if you can't rely on the rash, which is, you know, diagnostic in and of itself, and you can't rely on the test, we're in a pretty big pickle here. And this, you know, should have told us long ago that we need to change the way we think about Lyme disease, the way we fund it, and the way we treat it. And funding, you know, on the funding question, the National Institutes of Health have given about $20 to $25 million a year for Lyme disease for many years. It has not changed. And on a per patient basis, Lyme disease gets maybe $150 per patient. West Nile virus, meanwhile, West Nile virus, which is mosquito born, gets about $7,000 a year per patient. There are many, many fewer cases of West Nile virus than there are of Lyme disease, and not to mention all those other tick-borne diseases we have out there. For some reason,
do you want to talk a little bit about the other tick-borne diseases? Because, you know, it's not just one kind of infection that comes in. It could be multiple different kinds, and each person could have a different mix, for example.
Right.
Isn't that so?
Well, yes. And often doctors look only for Lyme disease, and they don't really think or know to look for other tick-borne diseases when someone with a tick-borne comes to them and is ill. So really the second probably most serious and prevalent tick-borne disease is babesiosis. And Babesia, mm-hmm. the germ that causes it, is like malaria. It is a parasite. It gets into your red blood cells. It's very serious. You get drenching night sweats and fevers and just very serious symptoms. There is a fatality rate with babesiosis, which varies by study, but maybe about 5% of people. It's also gotten into the blood supply. It can be carried asymptomatically, meaning that you don't have symptoms. You just carry it, and it passes to blood you donate and sometimes to patients who get that blood. Fortunately, they have finally developed a test to screen for it, but the test isn't being used all across the country, and nor is it being used for every type of babesia. Other tick-borne diseases, up and coming, is Powassan virus, a very serious illness that can cause, in about 50% of cases, leaves people with ongoing neurologic problems. They can't walk. They can't function cognitively. Serious problems. Luckily, that's, you know, only a very small number of cases right now. But, you know, we were at a point where Lyme disease had a very small number of cases at one point as well. So it's something to watch. Ehrlichiosis, anaplasmosis, all tick-borne. Another very concerning development in this world of ticks and tick-borne diseases is something called the Asian tick. It's the Asian long-horned tick. Now, in the last 50 years, we had no new tick species until this one showed up inexplicably in New Jersey. We don't know how it got here from the other side of the world to a sheep farm in New Jersey. But since then, it has shown up in six other states. It's in Westchester County, a very heavily populated suburb of New York City. And it is just turning up here and there in the South, in the Northeast. And this is really a tick that is to be watched. We don't really know what the capabilities of this tick are. In Asia, it causes a very serious, often fatal disease. Luckily, none of the ticks that have been found here have been infected with this particular virus. But again, just as with Powassan, we have to be vigilant. We have to do the research. We have to find out what's going on out there in the environment and what's mm-hmm. causing it.
This summer, we're having a much warmer summer, due to global warming, most likely. This warmer weather is increasing the propagation. You're saying in the book. Can you just go over that for our listeners?
Yes. Well, you know, climate change is unfortunately a political issue in the U.S. For reasons that escape me, because it's really solid scientific consensus that we have altered the climate because of the gases that we have put into the environment. But, you know, I don't try and make the case that climate change is real. What I do in my book is I look at all the evidence that correlates changes in the climate, changes in the weather, to the rise of ticks. And we have pretty good old data from Europe in particular, which shows that ticks could survive, for example, at about 800 meters up a mountain in the Alps in the late 1950s. Well, about 50 years later, another scientist goes up that same mountain and finds those ticks are living at 1,200 meters. We are finding this happening around the globe. We're finding ticks moving up Scandinavia, up the Swedish coast, for example, where there's also been tick mapping from years ago, which shows, okay, these ticks are just climbing up latitudes. And it's not just warmer weather that's doing this. It's not more extreme weather, because ticks can survive very, very cold winters. We've known that. It's also changes in rainfall. It's changes in humidity. Those are other climatological factors that are involved. But as I said before, also, it's changes in the environment itself and the fact that, you know, we don't have this balance of species, of one keeping the other under control. So we've really just set in motion all of these factors that have allowed this bug, which, by the way, has been in the environment for likely eons, to really proliferate and propagate and just move around the planet. I was frankly astonished at how widespread Lyme disease is, and moreover, how controversial it is as well in other countries around the world. You know, because of the influence of American medicine, the way that we treat Lyme disease here is very much the way that it's treated in the UK and in Sweden and in Norway and in France and in many other countries around the world. It's in Australia, where they haven't yet officially even recognized it because they haven't been able to identify the actual pathogen in the ticks. But, you know, similar to the situation we have here in the United States, people who have Lyme disease wind up going in other countries to many other doctors. They wind up crossing borders to get care. I interviewed a man in England, for example, who flew to California to be treated for Lyme disease. I interviewed people in Sweden who went to England to get treated for Lyme disease. You have this sort of globe hopping going on by people who can afford to do this to get care for Lyme disease. And, you know, another issue that we can also talk about is the doctors who treat Lyme disease and the problems that they have had. This is a very serious, tragic, unfortunate reality of Lyme disease, that doctors who are willing to put themselves out there, to try different things, to give longer courses of antibiotics, which they know are not curative but help some people, have often been brought up on charges before licensing boards. They have been reported to these licensing boards, which are run usually by their state governments, by insurance companies. Insurance companies will flag these doctors because they're giving long courses of antibiotics for Lyme disease, because they're using other treatments for Lyme disease. And, you know, many of these doctors have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars defending themselves. They faced charges from these boards for the way that they treat Lyme disease. And that hasn't only affected them. It has caused other doctors to say, I'm not going near Lyme disease. It's too controversial. It's too risky. I want to keep my license. I don't want to get hassled. And, you know, the people who are suffering are the patients. It's a terrible situation.
Yeah, that's really, gosh, you know, it's, what you're saying is there are many different kinds of viruses and bacteria that accompany the spirochetes. There are many different, you know, kind of scenarios whereby people are either aware or unaware that this happened. We know that, you know, there are many different kind of, the immune system is variable in people. Not everybody, you know, has a great immune system. Some people could have an undermined immune system. And yet with all these variabilities, you know, there's supposed to be this rigorous protocol that the insurance companies have devised and everyone needs to follow it. On the other side of it, if you do go to try to treat it with herbs, food, and lifestyle, you know, then you're out of pocket on that. And so that also disadvantages, you know, populations, segments of the population that can't afford to do that. So, you know, the health insurance company says this is what you get, and it either works for you or it doesn't work for you, and they don't care. And so, you know, it's really in their interest to sort of systematize a complex illness or any illness, in fact, and lay down these very rigid parameters, you know, and this is what we'll do for you, and this is what we want, and they're making a medical decision on your behalf. And, you know, the reality of people's illnesses, you know, is quite individual. And, you know, and we're not treating it individually and not even a lot, not curing it for treatment individually. And then even suing people who, you know, are harassing or denigrating people who do treat it individually for those who can afford it. So this is really, you know, I'm sure that the tick bite doesn't discriminate and say, oh, you know, I'm only going to bite, you know, I'm only going to bite someone who could afford this or that. And yet we're stuck with this kind of system, you know.
Those are all huge, huge issues. But, you know, lest mm-hmm. I leave people with the impression that this is a hopeless situation, I would say mm-hmm. that there are some encouraging signs on the horizon. We do have mm-hmm. a meeting in Washington now, something called the Tick-Borne Disease Working Group. And it was formed mm-hmm. with people across the spectrum of Lyme interests by the government mm-hmm. to kind of reanalyze, mm-hmm. to take another look at how we manage tick-borne diseases in America. They're doing mm-hmm. some good work. They're looking at, you know, how to prevent. They're looking at how to diagnose, how to treat. They're looking at vaccine possibilities. So they'll come up with some sort of consensus document at the end. There have been some subcommittee reports already that will kind of point us in a better direction. I have no doubt that there will be better guidance as to what we need to do going forward. It won't be perfect because, you know, we still have a lot of disagreement in the Lyme community as to, and the mainstream community as to how to approach this. But that's encouraging. What we're also mm-hmm. seeing is we're seeing more attention by the media to this problem. You know, for a long time, there were newspaper stories and radio and TV broadcasts that painted people with Lyme disease who believed they were chronically infected as rather, you know, crazy or misguided. We're not seeing mm-hmm. that anymore. There is a mm-hmm. growing acceptance that this is a serious and sometimes intractable disease. So I'm really glad about that. But at the same time, mm-hmm. I do fault the media to an extent for, you know, mm-hmm. going along with that kind of very dogmatic view of Lyme disease and not questioning it. I, you know, as an investigative reporter, I'm really the first who came at this to this as an outsider who didn't have chronic Lyme disease and who really took a mm-hmm. tough top-to-bottom look and said, hey, guys, mm-hmm. there's something wrong with this picture. The other mm-hmm. thing, you know, I think there is more awareness by doctors, and I do see a little bit more aggressiveness to treatment. These are just anecdotal reports that I'm getting from patients, but I think docs are also starting to get the message. We got to do something different mm-hmm. on this. So
you know,
that's
really
some of the good news.
I want to applaud you, really, for taking this on because, you know, when you're a leader on a story, you know, you're breaking ground. It isn't easy. There's a long road ahead. And also, you know, I cover Lyme fairly regularly. I don't have it either. I think it's really important when this is the job of a journalist, you know, so we're advocates for people. It doesn't necessarily mean, you know, it's affecting us personally, because if it's affecting anyone personally, like if somebody stood up, for example, on my Facebook page and said, this affects me personally, I have lived through this thing, then instead of people listening and saying, well, it happened to one person or five people or 100 people or 1,000 people, you know, gosh, that might be serious. It could happen to me. Instead, the attitude is more like, oh, well, then you have some vested interest and you must be a crank, you know.
Yes.
And you know, so there's like this tendency to disbelieve rather than actually being open to the evidence, mm-hmm. which can be slow coming in because, as you point out, when something isn't funded, for research, then we don't, you know, it's underfunded in the way you described, then we don't have the evidence that people are screaming for. And so the first evidence then becomes clinical. It is the people who are saying, this is what I'm experiencing, that is what I'm experiencing. And, you know, if we don't listen to them, then it becomes more people and more people. And we see this with Roundup. First, they studied the lab animals. Monsanto said, you know, no, you know, we don't believe this science. And, you know, now the recent case is because it's affecting hundreds of humans who are developing cancers, which the outcome of the animal test predicted, saying that this was a carcinogen, mm-hmm. that glyphosate was a carcinogen. So I, you know, I always just counsel people for more openness. But I'm also curious, how did you get the backing of your publication and of others to, you know, to proceed with your investigation in the face of, you know, that kind of endemic doubt?
That's a really good question, and it really goes back to a couple of things. First, I had a very long track record of investigations, of proving cases, of having a previous book, of winning a lot of awards, frankly, for my investigative reporting. So I really had the confidence of my editor. But not everybody has a great editor like I had, working at a small newspaper, which devoted the resources to investigative reporting. And, you know, for that, I'm just so thankful. My editor began to read my stories, and he said, his name is Stu Shinsky, a terrific guy, he said, you know, you're onto something, keep going. And because of his, you know, confidence in me, because he led the way at my newspaper in saying, we're going to spend the money on investigative reporting because it's important. That all combined to let me loose and do my thing. And, you know, it's not mm-hmm. a great time to be a journalist in America today. We don't
Indeed.
Devote the resources to it. We probably never mm-hmm. have devoted enough resources to investigative reporting, but it's even more difficult now. And I just thank the heavens that I was where I was when I was, that I was able to do this and then go on to do a ton more research on my book. And I'm no longer at the newspaper. I'm an independent journalist now, but I'm going to see this through.
mm-hmm. Well, it's really great and that happened. And, you know, it's, you know, you that those circumstances lined up so that, you know, that, you know, we can have this book. And so we're talking today, listeners, again, with journalist, investigative journalist Mary Beth Pfeiffer about her book, Lyme, The First Epidemic of Climate Change. This is published by the Island Press. You can find it on Amazon, where, in fact, congratulations, it's selling really pretty well for a book on a seemingly obscure topic. And with a lot of positive reviews. So, you know, that's really gratifying and wonderful to see. And, you know, I hope
And I welcome listeners to put up their own reviews. They don't necessarily have to have purchased it through Amazon. I love the feedback, and it helps the publication.
Oh, that's great. Yes, of course, that makes perfect sense. And also, you know, listeners, do buy the book, learn more, and if you know somebody who is struggling with this or, and, you know, curious about it or has friends or family who's struggling with it, please do share this radio program after it's broadcast live today. It's going to be available in our archives at Connect the Dots Podbean, PODBEAN. com, and please do share it forward so that other people can get the benefit. And also, it's quite interesting because, you know, I report on health and the environment. Many years ago, someone, a top editor who didn't understand the natural connection between these two things, you know, treated them like separate worlds because we can niche them, you know, in a vertical. And they were like, oh, you're all over the place. But in fact, this is intimately connected, as this book shows. So it crosses that bridge to connect them both. I think it's really important for everyone to understand that connection and to think of it that way. So I want to thank you so much for being with us today, Mary Beth Pfeiffer, with your book, Lyme, The First Epidemic of Climate Change. Great luck to you in the book, and thank you for doing this important, important work.
It was my pleasure and honor, Allison. Thank you.
And thank you, listeners, for being with us on today's edition of Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Be well.
Well.